Welcome today. This is Sean Lindsay. Today we're talking about transitions and the way that Buddhist teachings and practices intersect with that. Joining me for today's discussion are Kim Sicca and Laura Riggs. You two want to introduce yourselves? Laura, you want to start?
Sure. I'm Laura Riggs. I've had several faith transitions, I would say, in my life. I started out raised as a Catholic. That was something that I think even as a child, I immensely disagreed with, just the Dharma of the church, and then have had several, run into questioning my continued belief in different, practices of yoga and just spirituality in general, I guess. Leaning more towards atheism at this point.
Great. Thanks, Laura. Kim, you want to introduce yourself too?
Sure. This is Kim Sicca. Like Laura, I've gone through a couple transitions myself. I was raised Christian Scientist, and then about 5 years ago, not knowing that I really disagreed with some of the stuff, I found yoga. And through that, Buddhism. And so I'm kind of in this constant state of transition lately, not necessarily agreeing or disagreeing with anything, just learning. So that's kind of where I am.
Cool. Well, rather than dipping into my own upfront, I think you'll hear about a couple of my own transitions over the course of the Dharma talk. Please feel free, as usual, to interrupt with questions or ideas or points for clarification. And I look forward to this. I've been looking forward to this for some time, so thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A couple of years ago, my youngest son was going through the challenge of seeing in his first days of high school that the ways of living and thinking and socializing in middle school weren't going to cut it for him anymore. And as fate would have it, I was going through the process of letting go of some comfortable ways of situating myself in life that had, I'd actually already gone through a change of view and a change of understanding, but I discovered that I was still clinging to some of the ways that I'd previously built. They were perfectly useful structures and behaviors in the way that I had been viewing things previously, but I hadn't recognized that they were already outlived their usefulness. And so I was going through a bit of a transition myself at the same time. But that transition for me was less painful than previous ones had been. And it felt more like the shedding of skin than the change from a caterpillar to a butterfly. As fate would have it, the transitions both of ours were coming to a head at the end in the fall of a year here in Colorado. And it was kind of a classic Colorado October. Warm, sunny days and chilly evenings and cold nights. Halloween was approaching and yard work needed doing. And those kind of melded in my mind with the transitions we were both facing. And what came from that concoction was a scarecrow for our front door. This one was made from spent blackberry canes we twisted together with frost-shriveled tomato vines, with even a few left frost-shriveled tomatoes still hanging on that we positioned as eyes and mouth. We dressed the scarecrow in an old work shirt that I'd snagged and torn in a couple of places and some worn-out Levi's from my closet and sat him beside the front door for Halloween. A few days after Halloween, we took him into the backyard at sunset and put him in one of those backyard ceramic fire pits and set him to blaze. As we reflected together on what our new stages were requiring of us, we allowed the scarecrow to carry away something of our old selves with the bright flames and the wind-twisted smoke and the gray ash. And it was chilly out, so as we stood as near to the fire as we could, and we roasted marshmallows over the embers. Not every death is quite so congenial, and not every birth is quite so easy. But if I get to orchestrate my next death and rebirth cycle, I'm totally going to include marshmallows. But once we reach adulthood, it's an easy habit to look back at our memories of how we were in the past and to kind of see stages of development behind us. Sometimes we look at our former selves in those stages fondly, sometimes nostalgically, sometimes pretty judgmentally, and sometimes truly harshly. One Sunday, my family and I were attending a church meeting on the south side of Chicago, where we lived a bit more than 20 years ago. And it was a kind of meeting where it was kind of open mic. People could get up and express their feelings to the rest of the congregation. And one of the young men in that congregation, if I remember correctly, he was like 12 or maybe a small 13 years old, but he got up and waited for his turn at the microphone and then began to, his testimony with something along the lines of, "Brothers and sisters, as I look back on my life, I experienced much hardship and difficulty when I was a youth." All of the adults in the room stifled chuckles. But to be fair to the 13-year-old who was speaking, we all do this sort of thing. Every time we reflect on what we are today by reference to what stories we tell ourselves about what we were yesterday or last month or last year or last decade, it's just the way a standard self, an ego, behaves. It's really the same trick, whether the ego's developed enough to see itself as others see it or whether it's completely absorbed in its own self-reflection, like that cute 13-year-old. One of the ways the self engages in kind of shameless self-promotion is at the expense of all the prior selves. It's kind of stuck with the memory of now abandoned ways of thinking and construing experience. And perhaps we remember when we as children, we might have believed profoundly in the magic of a fur-clad elf climbing down chimneys to deliver toys worldwide all on the same night. But despite how certain we can be that our prior magic worldview was wrong or limited or mistaken, the self almost never allows us to even consider whether, let alone to perceive how, our current way of thinking is also limited and incomplete. And because of that self-created blindness, we're generally pretty bad at recognizing the onset of a transition to a new way of thinking. Instead, the onset of a transition and new development, we almost uniformly see as a crisis. As I indicated, for today's discussion, I'd like to talk from a Buddhist perspective about faith transitions. I'm going to borrow a couple of core points from observations made by a guy named Ken Wilber, a philosopher and a psychologist and a pundit who also happens to live here in Colorado. One of his observations about significant changes in a person's life is that they tend to either be horizontal or vertical, what he calls translations or transformations. A mundane horizontal change might be dropping AT&T mobile service and signing up with Verizon. That's trivial, but horizontal changes can be wrenching as well, like when we decide to change from being childless to becoming a parent, or to change from being married to getting divorced. And of course, there are faith changes that are also horizontal. They happen when a member of a congregation learns unexpected information about the church or the pastor that leads him to change his affiliation to a different church, maybe one that better fits his experiences and his values. A horizontal change is a change that alters the content of an individual's affiliation or beliefs or actions, but does not entail a change in the way that the individual understands his relationship to the world, how he actually thinks, or how he experiences life. The other kind of change, what I'm calling today a vertical change, is a change that transforms the ways that a person understands. In a religious context, a horizontal change might be from Methodist to Muslim or Muslim to Hindu, a change of content that can be pretty momentous, but it's still going to be horizontal if the same way of thinking that was applied while one was a Muslim is the same way of thinking that one uses after converting to Hinduism. A vertical change, though, is one that first and foremost is a change in the individual as an individual, a change in the way that the person understands her relationship to existence, to other people, to the world, a change in the very way that she processes information. It can, but need not necessarily, entail a change of belief tradition. For an example, for some people it makes sense to evaluate a particular question by consulting with sources of information that are recognized by the community. A commonly approved canon of scripture, teachings by authorized teachers and leaders. If her view of herself is as a person who is part and parcel of a community, she's going to locate her identity in that community. She's going to depend on the community's agreed upon values and beliefs and practices. And some folk can quite comfortably live a good and happy and fulfilling life all within the community defined value system and the community defined perspective of a community defined world. A horizontal change from that world is a change from one community of values and authorities and validations and loyalties to a different community's established values and authorities and loyalties and validations. But a vertical change from that world happens when she starts to perceive where the authority of those values and authorities and validations and loyalties, where that comes from. It comes from the individual who's choosing those values, honoring those authorities, enjoying those validations, and demonstrating those loyalties. When she perceives that she is actually formulating those all herself and providing them to the community, whether in the person of an individual or an institution or whatever, when she deeply and internally comes to the realization that she is the one making those tacit decisions, her way of thinking has just gone through a profound change. Mind you, even though her thinking now incorporates her awareness that she is the origin of her values, beliefs, loyalties, etc., doesn't mean she necessarily changes the content of them. If she previously believed in Joseph Smith's first vision story because it was contained in the Mormon Church's standard works, because the account was taught by church leaders and because it was what a loyal church member believed, she might now believe it because she values it, she finds it credible, she has interacted with it enough to develop confidence in its accuracy, she has decided to place her loyalty in it. Same for Catholicism, same for any faith tradition. We can participate in them and identify with them as a part of a community, or at some point, some people are going to take the vertical step of recognizing the way that they are involved in their community, and they take that individuative step. From the outside world, such a vertical change may be so subtle that those around her may not even notice it. But even so, there's a whole other layer of thinking going on. More is being seen, more is being understood, more is being processed in her after that transformation than was seen, understood, or processed before. That is a transformation, even if it's nearly invisible to people around her. But as we've already talked about, transformations seldom just happen on their own, and they almost never happen as smoothly as I just described this process. Often enough, we don't leap toward a transformation, which after all usually involves the profound cracking or loss or destruction or cratering of the only way we know of to experience life, the only way we have been relating to society and authority and to our very selves. Much to the contrary, most of us instinctually shy away from anything that suggests our worldview is coming apart. We're frightened to discover cracks in the foundation of the only house we have to live in. No, we try to plaster over the cracks. Sometimes we repaint or shift a rug to cover over the fractures in the basement floor. But why? Because until we actually make the shift, and sometimes for extended periods after we do, we have no stable framework for knowing. Not just for knowing facts, but for how to know anything. It's the not having explored the new territory of shifted thinking that leads some traditional believers to imagine that without a belief in God, we almost become amoral hedonists. And sometimes new arrivals in the realm of individuation do explore and try out new and different ways of being, and usually that works out reasonably well, and sometimes it doesn't. But for today's purposes, perhaps it's enough to note that the fear of ungroundedness makes transition seem quite fearsome. But Buddhism teaches that the very experience of not knowing, and even not knowing how to know, is terrifically important. There's a Buddhist story that comes to mind here. I forget where I first ran across it, but it goes something like this. So a monk is walking alone to cross the mountains to get to a monastery on the other side of the mountain range, and it's rainy and misty. And as he walks, the path narrows and it leads along the edge of a steep cliff. And though he tries to be careful, the monk loses his footing and tumbles over the edge in free fall. He thinks he's about to die, but suddenly he lands on a hard, narrow ledge. The mist is heavy enough that he can't see how far he's fallen, and he can't see how far down the cliff goes below the ledge. He checks himself out and finds that aside from some bumps and bruises, he's okay. So he finds the widest spot in the ledge, curls himself against the cliff wall, and waits for morning. Morning light comes, but the mist remains so heavy he can't see more than a few feet in any direction. He explores the ledge and finds a few stunted trees at one end, some berry bushes at the other, and he makes the best of things. He uses the trees to fashion a platform to provide him with a little more space, and he carefully gathers berries to eat and catches rainwater to drink, and so he lives on the ledge in the mist for days and days. But one night a terrible storm sweeps in. You knew that was going to happen, right? That's the way these stories work. The wind whips over the platform and ledge, shaking and howling. The monk clutches the platform to avoid being blown over the edge, but the storm strengthens and the wind grows and the platform begins to come apart. Rocks are falling from high above the ledge, and the monk realizes that he's going to die. So instead of clinging any longer, he gets to the edge of the platform and steps off into the mist, and he's startled to land on the solid ground a few feet below the platform he'd built. We build and then cling to ideas and beliefs and conceptions and opinions and even ways of thinking because we desire security more than freedom, because we habitually mistake comfort for happiness. So when storms come, when faith crises begin, Buddhist teachings tell us to turn toward the unpleasantness, the discomfort, the fear, rather than turning away. Without the storms, we might live our entire lives on makeshift and sometimes elaborate and well-appointed platforms that seem safer than letting go could ever be. But that's how transformational changes can feel as we approach them. Apart from stories about Zen monks lost in the mountains, how does Buddhism fit into this? It's this way. Buddhism, at its core, is about transformation, not about a particular set of beliefs or obedience to one authority or another. The central story of Buddhism is the transformation of Siddhartha Gautama. At first, he tried horizontal changes. He went from being Siddhartha the pampered princeling to Siddhartha the sadhu wandering northern India trying out different meditation practices to Siddhartha the ascetic who nearly starved himself to death. And none of those dramatic but still horizontal changes led to the end of suffering that he was seeking. As the story goes, after nearly starving himself to death, he recalled a day as a child when he'd sat under the rose apple tree and experienced one of those strange everything is connected experiences. A spiritual or peak experience, you might call it, the experience of elevation and peace and freedom. And remembering the temporary state of that day, he resolved to transform. He sat down under a Bodhi tree and stayed there into and through the whole night. And just before dawn, when he saw the morning star rising in the sky, a transformation occurred. Siddhartha Gautama became the awakened one. In Sanskrit, he became the Buddha. To be sure, there are plenty of platforms and stages that get cobbled together by Buddhists everywhere, and there are plenty of Buddhists who proceed slowly or not at all through the transformational stages. That's true, so far as I can tell, of every community that's ever existed on the planet. But the difference is this. Buddhist teachings are about transformation, even when those of us with Buddhist practices are trying to hold ourselves and our worldviews steady. And even more importantly, Buddhist practices, meditation, ethics, wisdom, all of them, are specifically designed to unbind the mind from its current way of thinking. Not because the practices will ever force the mind to shift, but yes, specifically to undercut the foundations of the house we've been living in, to bring enough storm winds up to dismantle the platform we've built on the precarious edge, to enable us to stop clinging to the way our minds work, all to create conditions where the mind can step out of its tattered clothing and out of its habituated thought patterns. So not only is Buddhist teachings about transformation, and not only do Buddhist practices tend to enable transformation, they also emphasize the importance of not trying to cling our way out of or through the experience of not knowing. The Buddha, like many spiritual teachers, sometimes taught in parables. Arguably, the Buddha's most famous parable is the parable of the raft. And I'll read you a clip from the sutta that contains it. The Buddha is speaking to his disciples, says, "Suppose a man in the course of a journey saw a great expanse of water, whose near shore was dangerous and fearful, and whose far shore was safe and free from fear, but there was no ferry boat or bridge to going to the far shore. And then he thought, there's a great expanse of water whose near shore is dangerous and fearful, and whose far shore is safe and free from fear, and there's no ferry boat. And the man collected grass and twigs and branches and leaves and bound them together in a raft. And supported by the raft and making an effort with his hands and feet, he got safely across to the far shore. Then when he got across and arrived, he might think this way. This raft has been very helpful to me, since supported by it and making an effort with my hands and feet, I got safely across to the far shore. Suppose I were to hoist it on my head or load it on my shoulder and then go wherever I want. Now what do you think? By doing so, would that man be doing what should be done with the raft?" And his disciples, very brilliant crowd of folks, says, "No, venerable sir." And the Buddha responds, "So have I shown you that the Dharma is similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, and not for the purpose of grasping." There are as many ways of understanding what the raft might be in that parable as there are occasions when we must leave a construct behind in life. In the Theravada Buddhist tradition, when one is fully awakened, there's no point to practicing insight meditation because the clear seeing that such meditation practices have actually become the moment-to-moment experience of the one who's awakened. So for that person, insight meditation might be the raft that he leaves behind. For those who are facing or recovering from a faith transition, it's tempting to view the raft as religion itself, something that can be left at the riverbank for those who need it after the river has been crossed. Sometimes a particular mindset might think of the raft as a stage of mind development. Like the young man in the testimony meeting, we may want to be done with growing and developing. Our egos may try to persuade us that we've cleared the last hurdle to awakening and no longer need the raft at all. But fully liberated beings are vanishingly rare and valuable creatures, maybe slightly less rare than unicorns, but not a lot. Most of us, like it or not, are still poling our raft across the river, and however much it may appeal to us to think we're ready to ditch the raft and light out for the territory, for most of us, the reality is that we're still suffering in diverse ways, and we're still causing suffering to those around us in diverse ways. An example of me not getting the point and suffering for it. A few years ago, I happened to be in a period when my meditation practice was solid and comforting, and if I remember correctly, I sat in meditation on a particular Sunday morning and really appreciated the mind space that I was able to find. At that point in my life, I would have labeled that as a good meditation, as if there were a bad meditation to counteract it. But that was the way I was thinking. And a few hours later, I was attending the formal meetings of the Mormon congregation that my family and I attend. I don't remember who was speaking or what the person said, but it was something that seemed misguided and presumptuous and condescending and utterly wrong to me and profoundly annoying. I was sitting beside my family and I was stewing internally. I felt offended, affronted, disgruntled, unhappy. Give me a thesaurus. We can come up with some more words for it. But I was contorted inside and debating whether to get up and go sit in the lobby for the rest of the meeting. And then I remembered the peace of the morning meditation that I'd experienced a couple of hours earlier. And the contrast with what I was feeling sitting in the pews was just too great. And at first, I simply wanted the peace and calm of the morning meditation. I wanted it back. I wanted to avoid the discomfort of being in the meeting and listening to statements that offended me. I wanted, in short, a horizontal transition, a transition from disgruntled Mormon to content Buddhist. And I was convinced that Buddhism was right in exactly the ways that Mormonism was wrong. I wanted my world to change so I would stop suffering. Let me say that again. I wanted my world to change so that I could stop suffering. And then it dawned on me. All that suffering was going on inside of me. While I was blaming it on whatever the speaker was saying, I was the one who was twisted up, not the speaker. And it occurred to me that if the Buddha were sitting on the pew beside me, he'd likely have been just as peaceful, annoyingly peaceful maybe, as he's portrayed in all those stone statues of him sitting in meditation. And with that insight, I realized that the discomfort I was feeling was the invitation to a vertical change, a transformation in me, a transformation of me, if only I was willing to let go of what I knew and allowed myself to not to know what the right answer was. So I shifted into standard Buddhist meditation instructions. I paused and I noted what was going on in my body. I felt the tension in my shoulders and the tongue constriction in my chest. I took a breath and let it out slowly. I felt the tension subside a bit. I noticed the sensation of the air moving across my face and hands. I felt my seat on the bench and the weight of my feet on the floor. Then I turned my attention to my thoughts. And one by one, I let go of the stories I was telling myself about myself and the church and the things that the speaker was saying, one by one. And one by one, I allowed myself not to know the things that I thought I knew. And the pain-inflicting storylines that I was repeating to myself stopped. And a few minutes later, I found myself sitting utterly calmly beside my family, not agreeing with the ideas and not even sharing the same perspective from which the speaker's ideas were coming, but calm and peaceful and able to see my own suffering more clearly and able to see how my muttered imprecations were triggering suffering in those around me. So what was the magic? I think it was this. I think it was suffering enough and not turning away from the suffering in a way that would prevent me from learning from it. And I think it was seeing that the suffering was not unavoidable, but rather was coming from the way I was receiving and experiencing and processing the experience of sitting in that meeting. The suffering was coming from my thoughts about myself. And when I let them go, when I stopped insisting that my secular Buddhist story win, the suffering subsided all on its own. The crazy simple part about Buddhist teachings regarding transitions, if you're suffering, find what you're clinging to and let go. Step off the platform you've carefully constructed to keep yourself safe. Put the scarecrow to the torch and be okay with not knowing. I don't know about you, but I've had a couple of occasions to travel in my life. And one of those, several of those occasions, I should say, have been to other countries. And one of the things that I've come to recognize about my experience of traveling to other countries is that for the first couple of hours, sometimes the first day, I'm terrifically uncomfortable. Those other countries don't seem to deliver what I expected. They don't feel normal. They don't feel they don't meet my expectations, and so I'm uncomfortable and I'm unsettled. But after a couple of days, in most cases, I've been able to settle in as I've let go of the expectations that I started with. But that period of transition is always uncomfortable. And I think one of the reasons it's uncomfortable is because we lose any way of knowing for certain what's going to happen next. And when we go through these major life transitions, transformations, I should say, it's like looking at the compass that we've been using to steer us, and the compass is broken and there's no way to fix it. And it's like, oh, I have to do without that compass. I can no longer rely, to take us back to what we were talking about earlier, I can no longer rely on my community's decisions about what is ethically appropriate. I have to make those decisions myself. How do I do that? I have no idea. I've never done that before consciously. And so there's a huge unknowing or not knowing that arises. But until we recognize that we don't have I'm having a hard time finding the right way to describe this. Until we realize that what we're about is living through the uncertainty of not knowing, we try to grasp onto things. We think, okay, well, the set of puzzle pieces that I was trying to assemble in one pattern, maybe they need to be assembled in a different pattern. Maybe I just need to figure about it a little bit differently. And we get into a stress mind. Sometimes that stress mind can last for a few moments. Sometimes it can last for years as we struggle to avoid letting go of the way we know things in order to make sense of things. What happens, though, is that we go from one stage to another. Buddhist teachings would tell us that everything is impermanent, and so what we perceive as stages are actually constantly impermanent experiences developing as well. But as a practical matter, I think most of us experience periods of stability that are interrupted by periods of transition and change. Usually we're such creatures of comfort and stability that when we go through a transition, it's painful and unsettling, and we seek out new stability and new comfort, a new order, a new system, a new normal. As soon as we find something that looks more stable, that solves some of the problems of the previous stage, we tend to latch onto it. We tend to build it. We tend to elaborate it like the platform on the ledge of a cliff, rather than recognizing or allowing ourselves to continue to recognize that we are constantly changing. One of my favorite comics I've ever seen is of this guy who's approaching the edge, and there's a sign that says, "Warning, bottomless pit ahead." And he stumbles into the bottomless pit, and the next frame of the comic, you know, he's terrified. The wind from falling is pulling his hair straight up into the sky, and he's clearly distressed. The very next frame, he's like kicked back, his legs are crossed, he's reading a book because he's still falling. It's a bottomless pit. He's never going to reach the bottom, but he's learned to live with the transformations of falling. Transformations happen only after we've encountered the rigid contours of our way of thinking. It's only after we've bumped our head or bashed our toe against the same boulder again and again and again that we look carefully and realize the ways that our current way of thinking is so distorted. And it's only after we've seen the mind tricks that are necessary to maintain a worldview, it's only after we've seen the suffering that results from the distortions and limits, only after all those things are we usually prepared to reevaluate the possibility of letting go of an entire way of thinking. But seeing those things is an entirely good thing. It's a good thing for a teenager to realize that the way he lived and saw and was in middle school aren't going to work in high school. It was a good thing for me to see how my Buddhist versus Mormon attitude was causing harm to myself and my family. That was a good thing, even though it was terrifically uncomfortable as I was there. What are the changes that you've experienced? And how have you been able to recognize them? Were the changes immediate? Were the transitions immediate or immediately apparent? Or did they come over time? Or are you still trying to identify them?
I would say my transition from Catholicism took time, but only because, you know, I still had to do kind of like you, Sean, with you know, appeasing my family of being, you know, they still believe in those concepts.
Looking back at that experience, can you see when your transition started? Was there a time when you were accepting of it?
I think it started from the time that I was asked to go through communion and confirmation. I resisted a lot of the teachings even early on.
Was that stressful?
It was, yeah. Oh, I was incredibly angry. And I don't think I had any other tools for how to work through the anger. You know, I didn't have a meditation practice or anything like that, because that's when I was still young, and, you know, that wasn't something that we were taught.
Was it apparent to you at that time that you were going through a transition, or is that something that you only discover after the fact?
I guess maybe after the fact, because I think when you're going through it and you don't see anybody else having the same kinds of reservations that you are, you think there's something wrong with you.
Been there, done that.
So I think that was part of it. And also having the confidence to know that if I decided to step outside of the church's beliefs, that, you know, that I still was okay as a person.
You had that sense from even when you were young, or that's a sense that you developed over time?
No, that's what I developed over time. I would say, you know, definitely didn't have it then. Of course, you know, the guilt that you feel is really more the overwhelming driver in that.
Yeah, I can relate to that. For me, when it first arose, I thought, oh, I need to get back to where I was before. I thought that I could. I thought that it was possible to go backwards. And then I began to struggle. And it's like it's not just like trying to swim upstream. It's like trying to swim up a waterfall.
Yeah.
It seems like a good idea until you actually attempt it.
Right. I don't think I had a basis of trying to get to where I was before. That's maybe the difference, in that I didn't ever feel like there was a before. I pretty much felt a resistance to the faith.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from the time that I started going to church with my family. So it was always just a question of, well, what's wrong with me?
So there was a sense that you were defective or broken or different in some kind of negative way from everybody else.
Yes, some way that my brain got wired differently.
Kim, how about you? What's your experience of that?
Yeah, I don't have any particular moment that stands out for me, like communion or anything. I just remember resisting, going to church every Sunday. I'd fake to be asleep. I'd go there and I'd kind of just be thinking about anything except for what the teacher was telling me. I just figured that was something I didn't like. But then years later, I found Buddhism, and I found myself going to every class I could find, and I was drawn to it. And then an interesting thing was, when I found pieces that didn't jive with what I had learned, which is amazing, I learned anything given how resistant I was, I resisted that. I'm like, well, how can this be? Because I learned this other thing, and now you're telling me that it works like this. So I learned that I had to make my own decisions. Like you were saying, you abandon the community decision and have to think for yourself. That itself was pretty scary. But, yeah. So I guess I never really noticed it was a transition until recently. It was something was wrong with me, because I didn't like where I was. I didn't want to be there, that kind of thing.
How did you experience the, or did you experience familial issues as you made those changes?
They thought I was just being obnoxious because I didn't want to go to church, and I was rebellious.
Were you obnoxious?
I was. Yeah. It was the, can we ever get this person out of the house? Yeah. Kicking and screaming, went every Sunday. But, yeah, I never knew why. And now that I've been trying different things, they've been very accepting.
That's good news. Well, maybe we can advance this discussion by expanding it beyond faith transitions. Sometimes we make transitions in the way that we relate to other people. And so maybe thinking about the hardest transition you've ever made, what caused the difficulty that brought about the transition? Internal conflict or external pressure? You ever had a relationship that became a pivot point in your life where you just were never the same after that relationship?
Oh, yeah.
That sounds like a loaded yeah.
Well, yeah.
Did the conflict that it brought on start internally or externally for you?
I guess I struggle with what you mean by the external conflict. Is it somebody saying to you, you have to change, or?
Yeah, that's okay. What I had in mind. Sorry.
Okay. I guess it was a little bit of both. You know, as you know, I think the past year and a half has been that huge transition for me that was propelled by several relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And if I look back, I think a lot of it started as internal conflict with the external situation, if that makes any sense.
No, it does.
Okay. I had signed up for, you know, being involved in a community that I realized once I was within the community, I didn't agree with at all. And so there was a huge conflict for me that I think I tried to deny. I guess it was that elephant in the room that I didn't ever really want to look at until everything exploded.
Yeah. Well, it feels like we've committed ourselves to something. And yeah. Once we've committed ourselves to something, we're really strongly invested in it succeeding. And then we have really concrete definitions of what success is. And when we realize that the concrete definitions of success that we've already set aren't possible in the situation that we're in, we either have to come up with new definitions of success, or we have to exit the situation altogether. or we can stay in and just be miserable. I've done that before.
Yes. Yeah.
One of the things that occurred to me over time that really made a difference in the way that I viewed life and experienced things was I went from thinking that my relationships with other people were comprised of either things that went well or things that I needed to teach them that they didn't fully understand.
How'd that work out?
I thought all they need to do is see things the way I see them and everything will be fine.
Uh-huh.
I had this part of the worldview that I held was that there was a right and a wrong. There was a correct way of seeing and an incorrect way of seeing. And I had the correct way and everybody else needed to get with the program. And moreover, I had this sensation or this perception that they would be better off if they got with my program. That experience sitting on the bench at the church, seeing my own internal conflict, was one of those moments when it finally dawned on me that the way that I was seeing was the defect. Part of the way that what I was seeing was that there was a right way and a wrong way, and I had the right way and everybody else had the wrong way. And what I've discovered, though, is that I didn't have to break up all of the relationships that I had previously had built on different ways of thinking. There's a kind of momentum, or inertia, I guess is the better word. There's a kind of inertia. The relationships that we have built with other people are perfectly capable of being transformed even while we stay in relationship with those other people. Sometimes relationships need to come to an end, and I'm not saying that they shouldn't. But what I am saying is that what often feels like a very threatening step, threatening to the relationship, threatening to the way we view the others, threatening to the way that we think about ourselves in relationship with other people, often enough, the transformation doesn't need to entail walking away from those things and taking on a whole new set of equipment or baggage or clothing or whatever analogy one wants to use. Sometimes we can step away from one way of understanding things and say, what is going on right now? And we find different ways of relating to the same furniture in the living room. You know, use an insulting analogy, I suppose, for the people around us. But there are different ways of relating to them. So maybe the wrap-up question is, reflecting on the experiences that you've had with transitions and transformations, are there lessons that you've learned that you would want to tell yourself, or if somebody came to ask you for advice, what would you tell them about how best to weather future transitions or transformations? Is there a way that you can be more aware earlier on so that you suffer a little bit less?
Well, along with what you've been saying, I would suggest just don't get emotionally attached to it. Maybe if you're a logical thinker, weigh the pros and cons. If you're stuck on the ledge and there's no way out, step forward and see what happens. There's no right or wrong, and you're just going to have to decide what works for you. You may try it, figure out it doesn't, and you want a backup, but maybe find out, like you have, that's not the way to go. So you have to pick route B that wasn't even in the agenda. So just see what happens, but don't get emotionally attached to it.
Laura?
Yeah, I would agree. A lot of it is that emotional attachment, or that attachment we have to the ego, that, you know, this is who we are, defined by the external. And for me, it really came down to body sensations, you know, and I guess part of that is just, you know, being a yoga practitioner, you get really body focused. But, you know, it was those, like, the digestive issues and the sleeping issues, the constant feeling of fear, you know, with the adrenaline rush that you have. It doesn't always have to be a thought that, you know, goes in your mind over and over and over. It could be those sensations for me that I didn't pay attention to that were telling me this situation doesn't fit. There's something about it that doesn't fit. And you trying to force it to make it work doesn't work with, you know, your equanimity.
I think paying attention to body sensations is a terrific practice. For me, it's the way that I see most immediately and most clearly that everything is changing all the time, which is one of the mechanisms that, at least for me, makes it easier to say, I don't need to cling to this. It's not just a matter of not needing to cling to it. It's frankly impossible to cling to it. So even trying to cling isn't going to be successful. When I turn my attention to what the experience of the body, you get that moment-to-moment sensation. You know, right now you can feel something going on in the sole of your right foot, and now you can feel the muscles at the left part of your spine, and now you can feel your left eyelid twitching, and now you can feel a little tremble at the right side of your lower lip. You know, that really fast cycling. And as my mind shifts to that experience, it's like, well, of course, whatever worldview I'm holding right now isn't going to be permanent. It's probably not even as permanent. It's probably not a matter of something that's even going to hold together for a few months or even a few weeks or even a few days. But I will cling enough to it that I'll try and preserve the illusion that I have it for a long time. But when I get to that moment-to-moment-to-moment sensation, and sometimes it arises in meditation, sometimes it arises outside of meditation, sometimes I can't access it at all. But when I can access that experience, it gets really easy to see impermanence, and when it gets easy to see impermanence, it gets easy to see that, you know, trying to hang on to a rope that's moving through your hands is only going to give you a rope burn. Closing thoughts?
This has been useful. Mm-hmm. Before this conversation, I was looking through the transitions in my life and thinking, huh, there have been more than I thought there were. And so it was just kind of a fascinating experience. And, oh, yeah, I was resisting this, and I was resisting that, and resisting that. And usually it came with a physical feeling associated with it, like a pain in the chest or whatever. It's like, oh, gee, maybe I should pay attention to that. So it's been good for me to hear this.
I'm glad. Laura,
I agree. Well, I always think that, you know, it's a pleasure to be able to spend time with you. So
I second that.
Well, it's good to get together, and I appreciate both of you taking the time this afternoon.
Absolutely. I was just going to say, yeah, I mean, I think it is helpful. Sometimes you think that maybe you, I don't know, looking back at some of the transitions, I think it gives me a sense of confidence in, wow, you know, I've made it through quite a bit. So, you know, why is there the need to fear a future change?
Wow, that's powerful, Laura. Well, that is.
It's a helpful exercise, so thank you.
I mean, would that all of us could see fear as fear when it arises. Note, yep, that's fear, but I'm not going to be afraid of it, and then go about our business.
Would be nice if it always happened that way, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it'd be awesome. I think that will bring us to a conclusion. I appreciate your participation, and I look forward to talking with you again.